This is Out of School, a podcast at the intersection of technology and education. My name is Fraser Spears, and I'm joined, as always, by Bradley Chambers. Evening, Bradley. How are you?
Good, good. We're back again for another episode, and have a new kind of thing this week that I wanted to do. Calling it Crossfire. There's an old show here in the U.S. that got canceled back in 04, 05 on CNN. It was like a political talk show where somebody from, like, the Republicans, you know, debated somebody from the Democrats. I don't know why I picked that name. But so what we're doing here is I've got, like, 10 to 15 questions that I have prepared that Fraser has not seen some are personal in nature, but not, like, too personal. But, like, it's more about, like, what's your favorite X relating to, like, technology and school and things like that. So it's really just to kind of for me and for the listeners to kind of learn more about, like, you know, your thought processes and what makes up you. And I enjoy learning people's, like, backgrounds and what drives them, because then that helps you understand, like, their decision making and where they lean on certain things. So Fraser has not seen the questions, and so we'll just we'll roll with them. So number one, what do you think was the biggest weakness of your last iPad deployment that you just completed?
The one that we just completed there, by far and away, it was problems with Apple IDs and when kids needed to put in a password to get an app. So we were using Apple ID based deployment because there wasn't device assignment at that time, so we were assigning to Apple IDs. But because we didn't want all age groups to have free access to the App Store, what we did was we had all these individual Apple IDs with a password that only we knew. But because of some changes that came along in iOS 8, and I think also on the server side at some unspecified point in the deployment, we ended the deployment with a situation where, in order for any of these non-free Apple IDs to get an app from the store, the teacher had to go around and put in the Apple ID password into every device, which was an absolute nightmare at the end of the deployment. So that was definitely something that kind of got switched up on us during the deployment in a way that wasn't really what I had hoped for. But it was, I really think it was the intersection of a couple of different configuration controls that were not really, in computer science, is an idea of, like, feature interaction, where you can test matrices of, you know, if we have this feature and then that feature, how do they interact? And sometimes I think that matrix wasn't maybe as complete as it could have been for iOS, particularly in enterprise and education configuration. And because of that, we ended up in a situation where with this setting on and that setting on, it meant we had this really bad user experience, but we couldn't turn those settings off because of other reasons as well. So that was definitely an issue for us at the end of the deployment.
Well, and that's where the device-based app assignment has been nice. That has definitely been nice.
Yeah.
So speaking of apps, I learned a cool trick today in my JSS setup. I had a teacher say, like, hey, can I get a list of the apps on our iPads, like just the names? Mm-hmm. And I found if you go into, like, and just pick an iPad in that group, and if you kind of just highlight, go to the apps tab on that iPad, if you highlight all that and copy it, it pastes perfectly like in an Excel document.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, so it includes, like, the version, if it's managed or unmanaged, and things like that. So that was something I learned today. Cool. So next question is, based on what you know today and your current satisfaction with Apple products, do you expect your school to be an all-Apple school for the next decade?
For the next decade? So that would take us through to 2027? At the moment, it's hard to see a new technology coming along that would change that for us. And if you think about what the new technologies are basically looking at things like drones, AR, VR, and smart home automation, for example. And I don't think any of those, within 10 years at least, supersede the idea of having some kind of general purpose computer with, you know, screen and touch and input and so on. I can see us maybe adding to it with other things, but I don't think that the core deployment will necessarily change that much. The only thing I can see that it still comes close is Chromebook. And I think actually, in my sense, is that Chromebook has actually stayed very stagnant over the last little while. Like, I haven't really heard a lot of news about Chrome OS particularly. I mean, there's new Chromebooks, right? There always is. But in terms of, like, major innovations in Chrome OS itself, I haven't heard very much recently. So I'm kind of wondering where that's going to. Although there were some big changes, not big changes, but new features in Google Classroom released recently as well. But yeah, so far, I'd say yes.
Well, and one thing that I've been thinking about is a lot is like voice input in the home, mm-hmm. and that really falls apart in a classroom.
Oh my goodness.
Terrible.
So I mean, the simple potential for sabotage is so large. You know, somebody runs into your classroom and goes, "Hey, sir, delete all my files." You know, there's a Dilbert cartoon about that from years ago.
Okay. Next two questions actually are great follow-ups to what you just said. Do you think, like, I've seen some articles recently that it's showing some new changes coming to Android, like in the tablet form, where mm-hmm. it turns it into more of a desktop OS, where there's like scroll bars and things like that. Mm-hmm. Do you think that there, you know, if you kind of saw Android and Chrome OS emerging a little bit, and you mm-hmm. mentioned there doesn't seem to be a whole lot of news about Chrome OS recently. Do you think that has a place in education? Like kind of a hybrid OS, basically almost like a Windows 10 style, but Android based.
Interesting question. A hybrid operating system. I mean, what does that look like in practice? You know, how is it different from just an iPad? You know, is it an iPad in effectively into which you could plug a keyboard and mouse and have a cursor? You know, I mean, iOS has already got part of a cursor. You know, when you put two fingers on the keyboard and swipe it about, you've got at least an iBeam cursor there to insert text. But I don't know. I mean, for me, the thing about hybrid platforms is they've got to bring the best of both worlds and not the worst of both worlds. And I think that if you're going to have a hybrid device, like the other side's got to bring something, right? So what am I going to get by bringing something like Mac OS X or, you know, imagine you were merging, say, iPad and Mac OS, for example. What do I really gain from allowing Mac OS into my iOS experience, right? I gain a few things in terms of file management. I maybe gain access to some legacy software, but even that's unlikely given the differences in chip architecture between iOS devices and Mac devices and so on. So at the moment, I just feel that would probably end up with more confusion rather than less, because if you look at what happened with Windows 8, for example, there's like, you know, a big Frankenstein switch that let you change from Metro to the traditional Windows UI and back again. And I don't think that like a 2-in-1 software computer just seems really weird to me. I'd much rather see effort go into, you know, making iOS as powerful as it needs to be to satisfy everybody's requirements. And it's fairly close. I mean, to be honest with you, in schools, iOS probably satisfies almost all of our technical requirements for students, at least, if not teachers, just quite yet.
Next question is, if you had a magic wand, how would you change the current deployment methods for iOS in schools? Like anything you could change, magic wand, fix it.
I would make electronic books revocable in volume purchase. So I actually had this situation today where a teacher asked me for a paid book from the store. And because we're using device assignment, you can't really do that. You've got to assign books to users. So I had to end up doing some VPP invitations again today, old school style, just to do that. But the fact that books, the licensing regime for books hasn't improved any over the years is a real black spot. I think iOS 9.3 brought so many great features for app deployment, but the electronic books thing is just almost a dead issue there because the licensing is so difficult. The only other thing I think I would perhaps change right now is some way to address in-app purchase in mass deployments. I don't know what that is, or some issue like that. And of course, the last one would be 5 gigs of storage for iCloud. You know, that's on my wish list. Is no surprise to anybody who's listened to the show for the past 3 or 4 years.
All right, next question. In your current role, what do you think like your biggest weakness is, or like what's an area that you feel like you need to improve on in the next 3 years?
Oh man, good question. I think being comfortable with confrontation, and that seems like a weird thing to say. Like, I don't mean that in the sense that I would necessarily go looking for increased levels of confrontation, but sometimes like, when you're in management, disagreements happen, and I'm kind of constitutionally, and not built for it, but I don't like confrontation, and I'd rather sometimes I have to kind of steel myself to deal with it rather than just letting it slide, and that's something that I think I probably want to work on as much as possible, just dealing with that. And to be honest with you, it's in all the times that I've actually had to deal with a problem like that, actually the real life situation is much less bad than I imagine it to be. And quite often I'm really guilty of building it up in my head to be a really big thing, and then it turns out that everybody was kind of on my side anyway, and it was all fine. But I had imagined all the kind of complaints that people would have, and they didn't have any of them. So things like that are, as I kind of move up in management, if you like, that's something that more of that lands on my desk. And I suppose part of that comes from, like, my background is in computer science and software engineering, and like all of my education and training has all been about fixing problems, solving problems, designing solutions to problems. And the more you kind of pull away from that and start moving into dealing with people, I still quite often make the mistake of looking at people as problems that need to be solved. And I'm kind of going, well, why isn't that solved? Because I did something, and why isn't it solved? And I'm like, well, people aren't problems to solve. People are people for a start. But they also, like, relationships between people, relationships between pupils, you can't necessarily just solve those things. All you can do is try and guide them along and manage them and nurture them and all these things that are not really kind of hard computer science attributes, if you like. And I suppose it's having to learn a lot of them quite quickly is an interesting challenge too.
But yeah, I go through periods at our school where, like, I'm doing more heavy technical things, and those are cut and dry solutions. One of the projects I did this summer was deploy a new website that's either done or it's not done. Like, yeah. It's a very, I'm a type A, there's not a lot of gray area with me. And I had a conversation mm-hmm. with my wife recently. I somewhat have an eccentric personality. And so I think that makes me hard to be friends with. And I think it's hard to be married to me and live with me, because it's cut and dry. I'm type A. It's black or white. Things are done or they're not done. And you're right. And when you deal with people, it's like it's not a problem to be solved. And there's often not a firm it's done. So if a relationship has to be mended, we've hugged it out. We're done. Like, we want it to be that way, but it's not. It's like if you're like someone that's, you know, like in a creative role, for example, having like being strict onto your task list and like heavy on, you know, the GTD methodology may not work as well when your job, you know, it's like, you know, for me, taking a walk necessarily isn't part of, like, you know, unless I'm like literally stuck on a problem, but like things are either done or they're not done. But like if you're a creative person, like you can be taking a walk and that can be working. Just because you're trying to let your mind wander. And I kind of like, I'm the same way you are. I struggle with that and have to bring myself back to, people are people. So like there are times, like, let's say this summer, for example, you know, I am like, you know, knee deep in projects that I'm not really busy per se, like that day specifically, but I have a lot mm-hmm. to do in a set amount of time. And so I like want to get in there and go, you know, full tilt till I'm done. And then, like, you know, if a parent stops by to drop off something and they want to chat, like, that is the most important thing I could do, is to talk to them. Yeah. But I have to force myself to remind myself that, like, relationships come before checking tasks off your list that have to be done.
Yeah, and that's an investment in relationships and in the future as well. And I think I'm starting to get that, but I'm not a natural at it in the way that some people, some colleagues I have absolutely are, and they can charm people and they can, you know, they see that as a big part of their job. And I sort of see it, I'm not saying I don't see it as part of the job, but I kind of look at my OmniFocus and I'm like, that's my job right there. And in fact, somebody needs a hand, somebody's got a crisis, somebody's got something going on, you know, staff member gets sick. It's really important for me to not go, you have ruined my schedule for today. How dare you get sick? Do you know what I mean? Which is sometimes the first reaction that kind of rises. And then I'm like, no, I mean, it's not their fault they're sick, right? It's not their fault that, you know, their child's sick or something like that. It's just something that happens to everybody. And, you know, that's a very, very big challenge in terms of just remembering. But the relationships part of education is super important, perhaps more important than the technical stuff that we do. In fact, not even perhaps, right? The fact that even said perhaps there is an indication of how far I probably still have to go in that.
Next question. what do you think you do better than most, like, system administrators, IT managers, computer science teachers? Like, what do you think you do better? Or what's one of your strengths?
Long-term thinking. Yep. So one of the things that people always ask me when I go and visit their school is they ask me, what do you wish you'd done differently? And I'm always stuck for an answer to that. I'm like, I did it perfectly. And I'm not always saying that I necessarily did do it perfectly, but like what I'm trying to get across to them was that I thought it through so completely that I evaluated all possible options and I chose the ones that I thought were right and I was correct in that. And that to me is, that's a skill that I learned very early in my first job, which was before I was working in the school. I was a coordinator for the computing grid that was designed to support the Large Hadron Collider at CERN. And what I did was I coordinated three universities in the UK to deliver computing clusters and storage clusters to store the data that came off those colliders so it could be analyzed by physicists afterwards. And that was such a kind of early and experimental project that I really had to come up to speed very quickly in long-term thinking, you know, because we were designing systems that were going to support a machine that was, you know, 8 years in the future at this point, and, you know, trying to anticipate the problems, the bumps along the way, all those things. That's a skill set that I, with absolutely the best will in the world in all respect, I don't see that skill set very broadly distributed in educational IT, to be honest with you. And I'll give you one example. I visited a school somewhere in the world. I'll not put it no more specifically than that. And I was talking to their IT guy, and he said to me, how did you decide to use iPads? And I said, well, you know, we thought about all the alternatives, and we decided this was the right one. And I explained to him the kind of thought process we'd gone through. And he said, how do you know that if you didn't try it? And I was like, is that really how we do it? Is that we have to sit down and physically go hands-on with every machine? Can we not use our minds to imagine or empathize with the future or anything like that? And that was, to me, that was, I've always been quite clear that that's such an important skill, and it's something that I have, and I can see from the other schools I visit and the schools that are calling me up now saying, how do we get off our BYOD program and onto a leasing program, that we did make some really good decisions back in the early days, and thinking it through in the long term is a skill that is probably something that I do, I think, pretty well.
Next question. What do you think is the biggest thing holding educational technology back today?
Leadership. Pretty simply, I think leadership. Leadership, money to a certain extent, but money's a bit of a red herring, I think, because I hesitate to say this, and I'm aware that I'm speaking from a very kind of privileged position, but like, governments spend a lot of money, right? You know, you build one less aircraft carrier, that buys you a lot of iPads, right? You know, in an absolute sense, there's enough money. It's just not in the right place, right? And it, what it just needs to become is a political priority in order for educational IT to be funded. So in a sense, that's not actually the hard part. The hard part, I think, is doing the culture change part that makes it both an accepted development to have computers in your school and commonly used, but also to change the culture around it so that it is a valued part as well. So acceptance is one level, valuing it is another level yet again. And I think really at the highest level, what we need is political leadership to make it so that our assessment systems become aligned with the fact that computers are now a common thing in our society. And it's something that I've kind of been on for quite a while now, is the idea that the notion that we're ever not going to be connected to the internet ever again in our future seems quite absurd to me, you know. But we still assess with an eye to the fact that the computers might one day go away. Now, you remember, like, in the early 2000s, when you were getting into electronic books and you were getting into digital music, people would come up to you and they'd wag your finger and they'd wink their eye and they'd go, what happens if all the computers go away? You won't have any books to read. And I'm like, if the computers go away, you are going to starve to death, right? you've got a much bigger problem than whether or not you've got a book to read in order to survive the day when all the computers magically go away. And I kind of feel like we have to, in terms of leadership at the very highest levels, both nationally and internationally, we have to get to a point where somehow we acknowledge that these tools are going to be part of everybody's life. And I literally mean everybody. I don't mean just the rich people. I don't just mean the developed world. I mean literally everybody on the planet will be connected to the internet with at least a smartphone, if not multiple devices like that. And I think leadership at all those levels is really critical. And without criticizing anybody in particular, quite a scarcely distributed resource. And I think, I know there are people putting lots of work into educational leadership, and we've known for a long time that leadership is one of the main things that drives educational improvement, not just in IT, but in many other areas as well. And I think it's really, really important to nurture both the current generation, but also the next generation of educational leaders as well.
So I think what you're saying is, if you don't have leadership and you don't have money, you've got problems. But if you have money with no leadership, you still have problems.
Oh, absolutely. And I've seen it with my own eyes at some of the richest private schools in the entire world, where they've got infinite money, but they've got nobody who can make a final decision about what it is the school is going to do as a whole. And at the same time, I've seen schools in very poor areas of the UK where parents are queuing up around the block to sign up to, you know, contribution schemes for their children to get these tools in the classroom. And, you know, I don't think the money is even in the top five of issues. It is an issue, certainly, currently, but it could very trivially be changed if the political will was there to do it.
Number eight, what is your favorite podcast?
Good question. I have really enjoyed Control-Walt-Delete. With Walt Mossberg and Neil I. Patel from The Verge. And I know if you follow me on Twitter, I give The Verge a hard time, but that is an absolutely outstanding podcast. And I really like it because, you know, Neil I. has quite a modern perspective, a contemporary perspective, and Walt Mossberg really has a great view of the kind of history of the computer industry. And they bring that together really well on the show. So that's definitely one of my, you know, must listens. Big fan of Cortex as well, CGP Grey and Mike Hurley. Hello Internet as well is one of my other fun shows.
Next question. How do you stay on top of like tech news and ed tech news?
I guess Twitter is kind of the default answer, but I have a number. I still use RSS, not every day anymore, but you know, once or two or three times a week, I'll pour through RSS and see. I don't really pay attention to EdTech news very much because I think so much of it is just complete faddishness, to be honest with you. So I don't subscribe to any specific educational technology channels or blogs or anything like that. I just think, you know, like that whole side of the internet, I think it's been overtaken by listicle stuff, you know. So you've got like 55 ways to use Google Classroom, you know, or 90 ways to use iTunes U and things like that. And I think, I don't just think that they're not very helpful, but I think they're actively damaging to teachers' practice in the classroom, because what I would really like people to write is, here's one thing to do with Google Classroom, and let's just do that, okay? Rather than giving people all these options. And sometimes people who are quite new to having that level of choice in the classroom, and they often get widely overwhelmed by it. You know, you talk to people and they say, well, I saw this article, it had 50 different ways to use Google Classroom, and here's the 15 that I'm going to implement this week in my class. And you can't absorb that rate of change, and your students absolutely can't absorb that rate of change. And that's something that I think we really... In some ways, I feel bad for not writing more on my own blog, because I think there's more to be said on that topic of how do you adopt technology in the classroom and what do you do with it, and at what rate do you adopt it as well. I think that's a judgment call, but I think it's pretty important.
Next question, number 10.
Okay.
You can only follow 5 people on Twitter. Who are they? And this is in no particular order.
Benedict Evans, number 1. Steven Sinofsky, number 2. Those two guys together are great. Who else? Mark Andreessen was great before he left Twitter. If I could resurrect him onto Twitter, I would love to have him back. So this is an A16Z love fest I'm giving you right here. I don't actually follow that many people on Twitter. I've got lots of people who are kind of friends. I'm trying to think. Somebody's going to be really mad at me for answering this question because... Christopher Finn, right, who has been a good guy. He used to be the editor of, I think, Mac Format in the UK, Mac Magazine, and then they started an iOS magazine called Tap, and he's now working outside of tech and magazines, but he's a great guy, and he surfaces such a lot of really interesting stuff. And probably maybe Ben Baharin, another analyst, he's very interesting to follow as well. So there's a jumbled together list of five. That's where you can tell I really haven't prepared an answer to this question.
It's by design. Because if I told you, then you're like, okay, who's going to get mad at me? Who might listen to the show?
Yeah, yeah.
Next thing is, what is something that you feel your school does really well that maybe our listeners don't know about?
I think one of the things I value most about the school is that we have a really strong culture of... parents and pupils not seeing each other as the enemy, right? I'm not saying that we're like best friends with the pupils, because that's a line that I don't think should be crossed. But there's a real spirit of cooperation and, you know, being on side that we have with pupils and teachers and also families as well. And I think that's something that I personally value a lot. And sometimes when you're dealing with difficult situations or somebody stepped out of line in a way that you really have to take action on, that is such an underground reservoir of goodwill that you can draw on at that point that it smooths out a lot of those conflict situations that I was talking about before, because parents can see and pupils know, even though they're, you know, getting hauled over the coals for something that's gone badly wrong, that really deep down we're all on the same side and we care about them as much as, you know, their families are obviously quite invested in the school as well and so on. So that's something that I really value and I'm determined to hold on to as much as possible.
Number 12, what is the weakest app in your current computing lifestyle? Like, what app could you replace really quickly, or what app really needs a strong update?
Well, I can tell you the apps that are really weak and need a strong update, but that I can't replace quickly, which is all of the Google apps on iOS. Those are all some really weak sauce, even compared to their web counterparts. And some people criticize the Google apps on the web for not being as powerful as Office, but on iOS they're even worse. So I think they have really stagnated badly over the past couple of years. Whether by design or not, I don't know, and I'm not making a statement that way, but I think that... those are apps that I could definitely see improvement on, but they're not easy to replace because they're kind of, you know, that's where a lot of our data is and so on. So those are some. I suppose the one that is quite easy to replace is the mail client, but I'm happy with Apple Mail. It's robust. It's not as well featured as the other apps, such as AirMail or Spark or something like that. But I try these apps all the time and I keep coming back to Mail because it's just solid and reliable and works very, very consistently for me.
Number 13, your favorite blog.
Favorite blog? Man, it's hard to think. I suppose Daring Fireball is still one that I subscribe to a lot. Or I do subscribe to. You can't subscribe to something a lot. You either do or you don't. But I don't know. I don't know. I can't even remember what blog I subscribe to. They just kind of come through. Benedict Evans has a great blog. I think I'm a big fan of his. I think he sees the world kind of in one of the ways that I want to see it as well, which is constantly looking to the next thing. And he had a really interesting tweet just the other day where he sort of said, this is a solved problem, what's next? And below that was a graph of all the people in the world connected to the internet. And I was like, well, that's a pretty cool way to look at that, because... you know, you can be the kind of person who says, well, you know, there's like 10 people in Siberia who are not on the internet, so not everybody's on the internet, but looking at it at a large scale, we're on the way to, you know, the forces are taking us to the place where that's going to be true. So I've always really appreciated his way of thinking, and it's something that I try not to slavishly follow the way he looks at things, but I certainly think that we're kind of aligned in the way we see some of these things.
Next to last question, you've got a big project coming up this week. You're probably going to have to work a couple 12-hour days. What food and beverages will keep you going that week?
Diet Coke and nuts.
Any particular kind of nuts?
Yes, very specifically. And people go out and buy this today. In the Tesco supermarket in the UK, you can get these barbecue-coated peanuts, which are like the snacking equivalent of crack cocaine. And I strongly suggest you try them out because your life will never be the same again after you try them.
Number 15, and the last question. What's the biggest regret of your career so far?
Biggest regret of my career so far? I probably should have left university sooner. I hung around too long doing too many postgraduate things. I should have probably got out maybe a year after undergrad rather than 3 years. But yeah, I suppose that's pretty much my main thing so far. I've never been somebody who has had like a real career plan. I've not been that kind of career type person, but things have worked out from time to time. Maybe I kind of wish I'd thought more about it, and maybe I made a couple of decisions that were not quite on the spur of the moment. But I'll tell you a true story that I was one of the reasons I decided to change my job back in the day was that I was homesick. And I realized I was enjoying it more being sick in the toilet than being at work. And that was when I decided I need to change my job. And that was a kind of funny way to, you know, think about career planning, but that was how I ended up working at the school.
Well, you know, it's funny. I kind of feel that way in a sense because I really like where I'm at now. And I also know that every decision I've made prior to now has ultimately led me to here. So even like bad mistakes in some ways led you to where you're at. And I also, I'm very content with where I'm at, but I'm also always like, you know, what's to the future. And I, you know, there may be something that like isn't even technically possible today that I will be end up doing in the future. So it's hard to plan for that. And then, you know, I think I mentioned before, I have like this huge, like massive imposter syndrome problem where, so like one of my main goals is just to make enough money to not like, or to not get fired, to have enough money to eat next week. I mean, it's like stupid, but that's kind of like one of my driving forces.
I get that.
It's like just survive, like, you know, provide for my family sort of thing. So yeah, that's kind of the same boat. But that's all I have. And so we'll wrap up.
Questions.
It's actually like one of my favorite shows in a while. That was awesome. And so next week we will reverse the roles and Fraser will come up with like 10 to 15 questions for me that I will not look at beforehand. And we'll see where we get. So thanks everybody for listening. You can check us out on the web at outofschool.net. We always love reviews in iTunes, itunes.com/outofschool. We have a Patreon page as well. If you want to support the show, you can do that on our website. You can throw us a couple dollars a month to help us pay for the hosting and buy new microphones and things like that. Check me out on the web at chambersdaily.com, and I'd love to connect with you on Twitter. My Twitter handle is Bradley Chambers.
Okay, and I am Fraser Spears on Twitter and spears.org on the web.
Have a good week, everybody.